Well, in C.S. Lewis's book, The Screwtape Letters, which of course is kind of a fiction about advice an older demon is given to a younger demon about how do you entrap people, how do you tempt people successfully. And so it's a way that C.S. Lewis used to expose all of the techniques and methods that Satan can use to lead us astray. And in one of those exchanges, the point was made that if you can get people sold on this idea of romantic marriage to the point where they will even disdain the notion of loving merely to keep one's word, then you will have won a great victory. And in fact, I think that's what we've seen in our own culture and society as we continue to think about marriage. You talk about this biblical principle of things becoming so bad that people call what is evil good and they call what is good evil. And I don't know if there's any aspect of our culture where you see that more clearly than in the context of marriage. And I don't merely refer to this past ruling of the Supreme Court this past year about expanding the right of marriage to those of the same sex. And of course, we all know that's not going to stop there. Once the door is open to say that marriage is simply an arrangement between people to do whatever they think is going to make them happy, then there's no reason it should be limited to two people. There's no reason it should be really even limited to people. And so you have people already arguing that people should be able to marry robots and they should be able to marry their pet animals and on it goes. There was even some woman who had married a roller coaster or something. Just ridiculous things. And it clearly shows a complete redefinition of what marriage is. But of course, it wasn't the Supreme Court that has redefined marriage. It's just making more obvious what has been the case in the minds of American culture for many years. A long time ago, people gave up the notion that marriage is what God has designed it to be. And by buying into this notion of romantic marriage and all that goes with it, the biblical view of marriage has been abandoned. And so it's very common if you talk to people today about marriage, the kind of things they will say about marriage is that, well, it's just a piece of paper. What's the real purpose or benefit of getting married? And other than maybe getting some kind of tax deduction, there really is nothing it adds to your marriage. And if you press people, of course, not only will they say it doesn't really add anything, it will actually detract from marriage. And so they would say, of course, really one of the most important things in life to experience is the passion of romantic desire and fulfillment. And it's pretty obvious that people who get married, it doesn't last. And so there must be a connection that marriage somehow stifles that and makes that go away. And so not only does this piece of paper not do me any good, it might very well do me a lot of harm. And so I'm not going to do that. And so it's this very dismissive kind of trivializing of marriage. And another aspect that goes along with that, of course, is, well, marriage is oppressive. Marriage is too restrictive. Marriage is giving up of your freedom. And who wants to do that? And especially as Americans that love our freedom, we want to be free. And so why would we want to get married? Along with that is the notion, again, bound up in romantic love, that the real potency of marriage and the appeal of marriage is just how spontaneous it can be and the authenticity of the feelings that you have, and once you settle into this married pattern and get into a rut, then going through the motions because you have to, that just robs marriage of its authenticity or feelings of their authenticity. It's not real anymore. It's not spontaneous anymore. And so again, we've lost something. And then finally, although not too many people would put it this way, it is looking at marriage through the lens of the consumer model by which most people in America live anymore. To make it sound a little bit more noble than that, we would say something like, marriage is to be measured by whether it makes you happy. And if it's not making you happy, get out of that marriage. Or don't marry that person if they're not going to make you happy. And so what we're basically saying is that marriage is to be evaluated on the basis of what you're going to get out of it, what you're going to receive from it. And when you think of that consumer model and how it applies, I mean, you would be a brainless idiot if you lived your life and you had the opportunity to get some product of better quality and lower cost, that you wouldn't do it. That's just stupid. And so that's this consumer model mentality that we have. If I can find a better deal somewhere else, well, obviously you should take it. Now you apply that to marriage. And so it's almost as if, even when we're kind of settling for whatever relationship we have, always on the lookout for, well, is there another relationship that will cost me less? Not necessarily in financial terms, but less that I have to invest in it, less that it demands of me, less cost to me personally in some way. Or am I going to get something better out of that? And of course, that becomes a pretty subjective standard. I marry a 20-year-old girl who's just fabulously beautiful, and then after 20 years, she's now 40 years old and not nearly as good-looking as she used to be. Well, here's another 20-year-old here that I can marry. That's a better deal, you know. And that's what you see happening in a lot of marriages. Well, what is really the answer to this? And I think, of course, certainly it's the biblical viewpoint. And I want to deal with these kind of in reverse order as we think about this. And first of all, I would say the biblical perspective is not based upon a consumer model, to say the least, but it is based upon a covenant model. That is, it's not what do I get out of this relationship, but what do I give to the relationship. We've already suggested that the biblical perspective about marriage is God has not designed it to make you happy. That is, at least directly, it will result in that. But that's not its purpose. The goal of marriage is to make you holy, and by that means to glorify God. And what that means is, it's all about what we do, the actions that we take, the gift that we give to the other person, not what they're doing for us and what we receive or we get out of this. Now, fortunately, our culture is not so corrupted as yet that we don't understand this model and this approach to human life. There is still at least one area of life where we honor this covenant model and approach. And one can only wonder how long this will last, because certainly we're heading in the wrong direction. But the one area of life where this still remains a legitimate way that people look at life is parents with their children. So here's a mother has a child, and she has a covenant relationship with that child, and it is to some extent kind of forced upon her. I mean, she may have, you know, gotten pregnant by a complete accident. She, of course, has made a choice to keep the baby, to give birth to that child. And that's still what a great many people will do. More and more there are those that won't. But think about that child. What is this mother getting out of this relationship with this child? The child doesn't really do a whole lot. And the child has to be tended to. It's about the most needy human being on the face of the planet. Nobody wants to deal with a dirty diaper. And nobody in their right mind looks at that mother and says, you know, if you can get a better deal at lower cost to you, you ought to take it. You know, go take the kid back and exchange it, you know. No one approves of that kind of behavior, right? And you're with your child and he's got this dirty diaper and it needs to be changed. And, well, do you really feel like changing that diaper? Are you enthusiastic about that? Does that give you the kind of thrill that, you know, romantic love gives you? No? Well, then don't change the diaper. That wouldn't be authentic. You know, that wouldn't be a legitimate expression of feeling and love. So don't do that. You just wait till you feel like changing that diaper, and it really gives you a thrill. And guess what? The diaper's never going to get changed. But instead of criticizing people for loving their children like that, instead of being dismissive about that and saying that kind of sacrificial love and serving of their children is that's just stupid, we honor that. And we think it is to great credit to people that they will love their children that way. In fact, we disdain parents who will not love their children that way. And why is marriage any different? What has happened that makes us feel like all of those things we honor about a mother taking care of her child are to be thrown out the window and oh, that's evil now? If somehow you have a marriage relationship with somebody in which that kind of commitment, that kind of dedication, that kind of sacrifice and serving of the other person, and that's what it's all about, in spite of what kind of thrill it may or may not bring you and so on, now suddenly you see marriage is evil. Marriage is oppressive. Marriage robs you of your freedom. But instead, the Bible calls us to this very kind of covenant mentality. Because I think God understands something about human nature. And I want us to think about this because it really becomes the foundation of what is distinctive about marriage. Now, it also has application to other things as well, as we will see, but it's at the very root of marriage. And so, in many ways, this is the power, this is the operating strength by which a marriage is going to be able to function and endure as God has designed for it to do. And it's rooted in Genesis chapter 2 that was read for us. And in our really fundamental passage of this series is based upon Ephesians chapter 5, where wives are called to be subject to their husbands. Husbands are to love their wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her. And what is being described here is a covenant relationship that these two parties are voluntarily entering into and committing themselves to. No one can force marriage on somebody. I mean, we can put pressure and kind of try to, but ultimately that decision to marry must be one that is entered into by this man and by this woman. And as Paul even quotes this passage from Genesis chapter 2 and verse 24, "For this reason a man shall leave his father and mother." There is a drastic transformation of the nature of the relationship that he has with his parents. And the same may be said, of course, of the wife. And he is joined, cleaves to, is glued to his wife. They join themselves together in such a commitment that they are no longer considered two, but one. They are this one flesh now. And what Paul is spelling out here are the consequences of this kind of covenant approach to marriage. And of course, this isn't the only place the Bible indicates that. In Proverbs 2, the writer talks about the adulteress who has abandoned the partner of her youth and broken her covenant. Malachi chapter 2, and among the sins that the prophet indicts the people for is for the breaking of the marriage covenant. And God clearly understands this is a covenant, and when we think of covenant, that makes us think of the role of promise making and how important making promises and keeping promises is. Now, you can't go very far in the Old Testament without realizing that God has high expectations about people keeping their vows. And so that just sobers us up again and says, well, all the more reason not to get married. You know, why burden yourself and get rid of your freedom by obligating yourself and taking upon yourself some promise? Just don't make a promise. And then you're just free kind of to do as you please. And if you hook up with somebody and it makes you happy for a while, then that's great. And if that ceases to be what brings you happiness, you go look somewhere else. You go shop at another store, that kind of mentality again, till that makes you happy. Well, the problem with this is that only by making a promise do we really understand what it means to be truly and fully human beings. Because after all, one of the distinctive qualities that sets us apart from the animals is the ability to make a promise. And a promise, by necessity, looks to the future. I mean, an animal may have some sense of history. the rat in the maze touches the electrified plate and gets shocked, and, you know, then he files that away and remembers that to some extent, and it affects how he conducts himself in the present. But there is no evidence that, you know, animals look to the future and have any expectation about the future. They're just kind of programmed to do their thing in the moment, but people look to the future. And our promise-making is an attempt to project something into the future. And what exactly is that? And perhaps it's because we make promises so flippantly, or don't even make promises at all, or don't care about keeping our promises, we don't really think through what all of this is about. But basically, when you're making a promise, a really fundamental promise, you're making a statement about who you choose to be. You know, you're saying, I am not merely the result of the genetic conditioning that my parents have handed down to me in my DNA. That's who I am. That's fundamentally what defines me. And I'm trapped in that, you know. Or that I'm trapped in how my parents raised me, how they programmed me, what all the conditioning was that went into whatever they taught me. That's just who I am. And that's where I'm stuck. And there's nothing I can do about that. Or that it's the circumstances that I find myself in, that if the economy is going well, or if I have a good job, or I live in the right neighborhood, or this, that, and the other, then I'm able to do this, that, and the other, but only because of the way my circumstances are. But what we are saying when we make a promise is, it's not about genetics, it's not about conditioning, it's not about my circumstances. This is a choice that I am making about who I will be. And that choice is so important because that's who the real we are. The moment we decide humanity is defined by just our genetic coding or our parental conditioning or other past circumstances of our life or the current circumstances we find ourselves in, you realize how really fleeting and uncertain any of that is. You know, the idea that you're just stuck or you're doomed, where then is your liberty and your freedom? Or if your circumstances change, then that's going to change who you are. That doesn't seem like any kind of freedom that I'm interested in. And so one of the things we realize is this covenant model that we are called to becomes the very means by which we are able to find true freedom. And so, just as we were saying, you can call what is good evil and what is evil good, so it comes to defining freedom. Everybody believes in freedom. But what kind of freedom are you talking about when you say you want to be free? And that marriage robs you of your freedom. Well, clearly you're defining freedom more in terms of, I just want to do whatever I feel like doing. And I don't want there to be any rules or any limitations or any expectations. You know, I'm just going to be me as I feel like being me. Whichever way the wind is blowing at the moment. Oh, so you're free, huh? And in reality, you're not really free. You're enslaved to your passions and your desires and your lusts and your feelings. And the Bible would teach us that's no kind of freedom, but as a slavery. And I would argue that marriage and other covenants that we make that are based upon good and wise principles actually enable us to have true freedom. They free us from being victims of our genetic coding, frees us from being victims of our parental upbringing. Now, that's not to say we're not impacted and we can escape it completely, that I can just do a complete makeover and be a completely different person than I've ever been. The reality is we carry baggage with us, but I am not defined by that. I am defined by what I choose to be. And that's where the promise comes in. And what I'm asking people when I make a promise is, don't judge me based upon my upbringing. Don't judge me based upon my past. Don't judge me based upon how well or poorly I'm actually doing. But judge me in regard to my true intention. And that's what we come here. None of us come here this morning to say, I'm the perfect Christian. You know, I'm the perfect, you know, child of God. I don't struggle. I don't have any problems. That's ridiculous. We all struggle. We're all sinners. We all make mistakes. We all do things that are stupid. But we don't come to brag about that either. What we come is to reaffirm, this is the kind of person I want to be. I want to be a perfect child of God. I want to be exactly the person God wants me to be. And that explains how we enter into marriage. You know, I mean, what person in their right mind could impose on another human being the kind of brokenness and inadequacy and failures that we are, knowingly? And so what happens for most people is we find out someone likes us and we're kind of like, whew, that's pretty good. I remember as a kid, you know, I didn't have very high standards for who I would marry. I just really one thing, if they liked me, you know. And I thought that was going to be pretty rare as it was. And fortunately, I duped somebody. And then I'm spending the rest of my early years of marriage like, well, I hope she doesn't find out who I really am. And you can see the kind of insecurity that breeds, because you're just one fact away from someone knowing who you really are and thinking less of you. That's freedom? No. The freedom that you find is in the ability that people can know the truth about you, but it doesn't affect how they feel about you, because that promise is there. That promise of being, this is the person I choose to be. This is the promise that defines me and who I will be. And that's why when two people enter into marriage, they make this promise. Now, more and more in the modern age, these promises sound more like, I promise to love you as long as we're both happy, as long as we both find this relationship rewarding and beneficial. It's just a here and now, this is how I feel statement. It's not really a promise of anything. But those who enter into marriage to make the promise God expects of them, it is to say, I promise to God, and I'm promising to all the people here, and I'm promising to the world, I'm promising to you, that I'm going to be there for you. And there's not a whole lot we can put in that promise, because you know the reality is you don't even know yourself, especially when you're younger at the typical age most people first get married. You don't really know yourself that clearly. And most of us are tempted not even to be totally honest about ourselves to the one that we love and the one that we're getting married, because of this fear that if they find out the truth about us, they won't like us. And their affection for us is based upon what we deserve. And if they find out we really don't deserve it as much as they thought we would, then they're not going to love us as much. And although that may be true, there's even a deeper problem, which is if you don't even know the truth about yourself, you can't tell the other person. And there are a lot of truths about ourselves that are hidden to us because we've deceived ourselves or we've blinded ourselves to those aspects of our character. But I guarantee you one thing, if you get married, those are going to be brought to the surface. Those are going to be revealed over time. And the question is, then, who are you going to be? Are you defined by those blotches of your character? Or are you going to be defined on the basis of that commitment, that promise that you made, that I'm going to be this person that's there for you? I'm going to be this person that strives to live according to God's will. And that is to say, I can't really be honest with you right now about who I really am and what problems there may be lurking here that I don't know about. But when they come to the surface, I'm not just going to throw up my hand and say, well, that's who you married. That's life. That's tough. That's the hand of cards you got dealt. No, it is to say, I'm going to be working on whatever those things are as best as I can. That's part of the promise that we make. And so the reality is, you know, my wife has lived with probably 10 different men since we've gotten married. I haven't kept count. And of course, I don't see it that way. I'm the same person I was. No, I have changed profoundly in so many different ways. So I guess she's entitled to get out of the marriage because I'm no longer the person you know, when we got married. She's not the same person that I married. None of us are. It's not possible to remain the same person. Marriage transforms you that much. Now, whether it will transform you for the good or not depends upon the foundation that marriage is built upon, the promise that that marriage is built upon, and how well we strive to keep that promise that we make. And so instead of basing our marriage upon the uncertain feelings that I might have of who I am or how I feel, it's based ultimately upon what I committed myself to be when we first got married. And then life becomes this kind of journey of exploration, of finding those blemishes, finding those faults, and dealing with them as the Lord would have us to do. And that's what you see reflected in Ephesians chapter 5, that Christ wants to sanctify his wife, having cleansed her by the washing of water with the word, that he might present to himself the church in all her glory, having no spot or wrinkle or any such thing, but that she would be holy and blameless. Now, we can't say the same for the church sanctifying her husband, but since husbands are as fallible as wives, here is the mutual kind of nature by which this marriage relationship will transform us and help us to be a holy people and thereby to glorify God. And it does so because it is based upon a commitment, a rock-solid commitment that you can't just have by this consumer model flippancy about, well, I'm just going to go with this as long as it's working, but and then, you know, first sign of trouble, I'm going to throw up my hands and quit. And so ultimately, this brings us to what is the real freedom of this kind of relationship, and that is defining freedom in a completely different way. It's not the freedom just to do as I please or pursue every impulse and feeling, desire that I have, but it is the true freedom of being known by somebody and still being loved by them. And that's really what all of us long for, whether we know it or not. It is to be loved like God loves us. You know, if someone loves you and you know that they don't really know you, and that's kind of the suspicion we have when we're first falling in love. You know, someone is just, their eyes just light up when we walk in the room, and they just think we're the greatest thing since sliced bread. And that just makes us feel good. It feeds our ego. Everybody loves to have that feeling. But there's this nagging sense inside that, if only they knew. They don't really know me that well. And then you're kind of faced with two things. If you're kind of more of a worldly thinking kind of person is, we'll just see how long we can ride this thing and keep them in the dark. For the Christian, it is, well, I'm going to try to be a better person. I'm going to try to live up to what they think I am and hope I don't fail too badly. I know they're not expecting perfection, but if I'm really working hard at it, then they'll appreciate that, and I will earn and be worthy of their affection. But see, even that still leaves us with this kind of uncertainty at the foundation of the relationship. What happens if the real truth comes out? Is that relationship really dependent upon whether we're deserving of their affection or good enough for their affection? And I would suggest if that is the real foundation of the relationship, it is not the kind of commitment and the kind of love that mirrors the love of Christ for the church. Because then what happens when you're dealing with a person who is undeserving? They're not the kind of person, and they're not the person you did marry. And it's not because they've grown and improved, but it's because they have regressed, and they're worse a person, and you found out to be they're less trustworthy, they're less honest, they're less self-controlled, and that happens. And so what do you do? And so, if we are able in a relationship to be known by a person and still be loved by them, that's real freedom. Because now you've been freed from having to put on any kind of pretense, be somebody that you're not, to pretend to be perfect when you're not. It humbles you, having a more honest appraisal of you and your self-righteousness and so on. And it strengthens you for the difficulties and challenges that will come in life. It makes you a better person. And to me, that's real freedom. Not this just, I just want to do whatever I want. And so which freedom is more important? Which freedom is more abiding? Which freedom is more freeing? Because there is obviously a sense in which entering into the marriage relationship is restrictive. It is exclusive. You're giving up some kinds of freedoms. And why would anyone do that? Because there is a greater freedom that can be experienced that will not be experienced if you don't enter that kind of relationship. The freedom of knowing the kind of love between a husband and a wife that is based upon that degree of love and knowledge combined together, as you know, the one movie says it, the love is when someone knows the worst thing about you, but they love you anyway. That's what we long for. That's the kind of love that we would seek to have. It's the kind of love, certainly, that God has given to us. And that's different. You know, the reality is that this romantic notion that every day between a husband and wife is just going to be this romantic thrill of excitement. You know, electricity's in the air and it's just chemistry firing on all cylinders. That doesn't last for anybody. Never has. And the expectation, you are going to be different. You and your loved one, your marriage is going to be the sole exception in the history of human existence. No, it's not. And so what happens when that spark dies down? What do you got left? Nothing. And so there's the divorce and there's the breakup of the relationship. That's not what God has called us to. And so if you kind of compare it, you know, shooting the rapids in some kind of, you know, rapidly flowing, you know, boisterous stream, you know. Well, there's a certain thrill to that and excitement, but there's also the place for the river that's just running deep and steady and calm. And that's the kind of love that God calls us to, not the one that's so uncertain and fleeting and dependent upon circumstances and feelings, but the one that's built upon a much deeper and solid foundation. And I think about that, you know, the first time I ever held a girl's hand. I mean, there was so much electricity there, we could have powered the city of Buffalo in the worst, you know, snowstorm. I mean, boy, it was like, well, I never experienced anything like this in my life. It was joy, by the way, in case you're wondering. Well, I probably held my mother's hand when I was very little, but I don't remember that. So, I'm talking about joy. And, you know, I hold her hand now. Fortunately, I would say, my mind and so on is not filled with the kind of thoughts it was the first time I held her hand. And that's not a bad thing. And I'm holding the hand of a different person, someone I've gone through life with and faced difficulties with and sinned against and you know, had to repent and be restored. And that's a different experience. And that's a transforming experience. And what God is calling us to is this deeper kind of relationship of marriage that is a greater kind of freedom that frees us to love in a real way, not just this kind of superficial, trivial kind of way. And so that's what I would say finally here is that marriage and the kind of commitment promise that's made in marriage is what enables us to have true love. Now, I'm not saying that romantic love has no place in marriage. That would be ludicrous. Or to say that, well, this kind of Christ-like love we should have for everybody, so how could Christians even talk about getting married to somebody else? Or it really doesn't matter who you marry. You know, you go out and marry some alcoholic out of the gutter, and you can be as Christ-like and sacrificial and serving them all you want. Well, that's true. But that's not the kind of marriage anybody wants, and it's not wisdom to marry someone like that. So how do you strike this balance here? Well, there is a place for romantic love, and we don't have that for everybody. It is an exclusive kind of thing as God has designed it to be. And we ought to seek to marry that person that we have that chemistry with and some kind of passion and feeling for. So I'm not saying that, you know, the Bible's viewpoint of marriage is just this kind of emotionless, passionless, you know, stripped of all romanticism. It's just not the foundation of it. And we will make that the foundation, and that's the sole concern. Where's the thrill? Then we've missed the point, because there's something deeper and more profound, and that is, where's the commitment? Because it's just like if you, you know, you got some rich girl who's beautiful, has everything in the world to offer, and some boy wants to go out with her and is kind of interested in her, you know, and you're even getting serious with her. How does she know whether he loves her for who she is or he's just interested in her money or in her good looks and so on? That'd be a hard thing to know. Now you got some girl who's ugly and poor, and some boy's interested in her. Well, and she doesn't seem to have anything else to offer. I mean, you'd think, well, maybe he does love me, you know. But now, I'm not saying, you know, we ought to seek out ugly people to marry, and, you know, good-looking people are doomed, you know, to always live in wonder. That's not the point. The point is that the proof of whether we really love somebody is not when they are being lovable, but precisely when they're not. And so, in fact, you know, a parent, again, who's taking care of a child is the proof of their love for that child in those moments when they're at the playground and everybody's just having a great time and, you know, it's all fun and games and it's, you know, Disney World every day. Ah, it just shows how much I love my child. No. When that kid is sick, when he's got that dirty diaper, when that kid's being obnoxious and rebellious, and he didn't want to hear the word no, but you still love the child anyway, then you know you're loving the person. And that's why there's value in loving a person even when we don't feel like it. There's value in loving a person even if there's not the reward of the thrill or the romantic that is to it. And so in those moments where those things may be absent for whatever reason, because we found out our spouse is not the person we thought they were, or, again, life happens, and so, you know, we put on a few pounds or a few wrinkles or this and that happens, and if those are the details and the circumstances that we based our marriage upon and they're taken from us, then where's the substance of our relationship? And so there you see again how marriage enhances real love, not a love that's trivial, not a love that is superficially based upon fleeting things, but a love that is based on such a commitment of being known and being loved. There's real love, and there's real freedom to love. And that's what God has designed for us. And we see that in 1 Corinthians chapter 13, for example, where Paul talks about love, and that love is not just the feeling. Love is an action that is taken. Love is that act of the will to consciously do certain things for people. And you see how that applies to marriage. There will be occasions where we don't feel like doing something, or self kicks in and we feel like doing what we want to do. And I've given up that freedom. And now, especially if I'm a Christian, I got to serve my wife. I need to do what's unselfish for her. And we're back to that kind of selfish unselfishness where I still do it because I know I'm supposed to, but I'm resentful of it. No, that's not what we ought to do. We may be tempted to do that, but what we have to do is to realize this kind of love calls us to always act and do the right thing, even when we don't feel like it. And then a miraculous thing happens. The feelings will follow. The feelings will line up with what we do and how we behave. And that's why when we dwell on the negative and, you know, we become consumed by that, we find that our feelings get even worse. We even get more negative about it. And we get more picky and more upset. And then what started out just an annoyance becomes resentment. But if we focus the other direction and we do the right thing, always doing the right thing, acting the way we should act, then the feeling will be there. And so what I'm saying is, marriage as God intends it to be versus this contemporary notion of just romantic thrill all the time, those are not mutually exclusive. And I would say that this notion of romantic relationship does not have the legs to carry on very long and to get you through the times of difficulty and so on. It's certainly not going to help transform you and make you less of a selfish person and more of a holy person. And so that is to be rejected. But our only alternative isn't some passionless feelingless, just robotic obedience of doing the right thing, we actually discover that that kind of commitment to the will of God and what is right with a godly person that we have chosen to marry, that that passion and that romantic feeling and so on will be there. And it'll, you know, not be a consistent level to it. It, you know, kind of up and down like life is, but what doesn't go up and down is that solid commitment and foundation that it's all built upon, the promises that we've made to one another. And so there's a natural desire that whatever the passion is that we have for one another, we want to keep that. You know, the Song of Solomon talks about this. Notice in Song of Solomon chapter 8, verses 6 and 7, this is what the woman says to the man, "Put me like a seal over your heart, like your most treasured possession." You know, you just hold close to your chest, like a seal on your arm. "For love is as strong as death. Jealousy is as severe as Sheol. Its flashes are flashes of fire, the very flame of the Lord. Many waters cannot quench love, nor will rivers overflow it. If a man were to give all the riches of his house for love, it would be utterly despised." You know, love is this great power, and you can't buy it. You know, you can't put it out. And so there's this natural desire we have that kind of passion and feeling that we have for this other person abides. So how can you make it abide? And the world says, well, you just got to pick the right person. That seems a pretty flimsy basis. You know, the odds, one out of billions, we're going to get the exact right person that's going to be able to keep this passion going. No. And again, history proves it doesn't happen anyway. And that's why these relationships are constantly falling apart among people who subscribe to this worldly philosophy. You want that passion to abide. Build that passion upon a solid foundation of this commitment and this promise that is made. And again, that will free us from the fear and uncertainty that we will have because we know ourselves not to be what we are, what we should be, what we appear to others to be. And it gives us a greater sense of security because we know that even when we discover these things about ourselves, our spouse discovers these things about herself, we still love one another on a deeper level. And so that does not affect these feelings and attitudes that we have toward one another. And we also have the security of knowing, I've married somebody I don't really know that well. And I will come to know them more and more. We come to know each other more and more. But it's the promise that we've made that is the foundation of what's going to happen and carry us through, not who we really are right now. If it hinged really upon who I am right now or who I know myself to be or who I know her to be, that's a very uncertain and insecure foundation for anything. But I know enough about this person and that they're a godly person and they've committed themselves to the Lord and they find their value and significance in Him just like I have found my value and significance in God. And that's not what we're looking for in one another. But we will commit ourselves to one another and make this promise to be there for each other and to go on this journey of exploration and to know one another. But it can only happen because there's that kind of security, there's that kind of openness, there's that kind of total freedom that can only be had by limiting yourself to this person under these conditions that God has established them. And so that brings us back to Genesis chapter 2, that the man and the woman were one flesh. And the man and the woman were naked, and they were not ashamed. And of course, we look at that and we're like, why did Moses put that in there? And he should have ended the chapter at verse 24. That would have been a much more, climactic point. That's a really great ending there. And then you got to go and start talking about naked people, it's like my brother when at our wedding. I mean, one of the great things I knew about Joy, and I've learned to appreciate more and more as the years have gone by, is she's just about as cheap as I am. And so we were going really cheap for our wedding. And so I got my brother do the service. Didn't cost me anything. Didn't even think about paying him. His wife was a cake decorator. And so she made the wedding cake and a groom's cake, which was chocolate. That's what everybody wanted. So I had plenty of yucky wedding cake left. No, I didn't even get a piece of groom's cake. But on the groom's cake, his wife was decorating, and she puts on there Genesis 2:24. James comes up and goes, "Hey, better not put 2:25. And he walks off, you know. And I'm just like, well, I got your joke, but who else knows? You know, they're going to have to go look it up, see what it means. But, you know, that's kind of what most, you know, especially some juvenile 20-year-old. But I really think there's something more profound that's being stated there. Just as the oneness does describe the sexual relationship that exists between the husband and the wife, but it's not only that. So also this physical nakedness that they experienced was part of that, but that wasn't all that it was. This physical nakedness, just like the miracles of Jesus in the New Testament, you know, Jesus provides bread for people, but it's really a sign of how he's providing spiritual nourishment. And he heals people that are physically blind, but it's really about spiritual blindness. And so here's this physical nakedness. You know, not a nakedness we share, you know, with other people. We run around naked. That's not appropriate. But there is this nakedness you share with this one person. And it's a symbolic of that kind of vulnerability and openness and transparency. And you talk about warts and all. I mean, that's what it's about. But it's much more profound that the nakedness we experience in marriage is this degree of just being completely open and laid bare to another human being. They know us, and they still love us. And that is a much more rewarding and much more free and loving relationship than anything the world has to offer. And so God calls us to a very different way of marriage. And so the real power of a marriage as God has designed it to be is this covenant, this commitment, this promise that is made of being the person God calls us to be. And we may not ever hit that ideal. We surely will not. But that's who I am. That's who I've chosen to be. And in spite of how far I've fallen and how many mistakes I made and everything else, how fleeting my circumstances are, what my past is, this is my promise to you. This is who I'm going to be. And that's what I'm striving for. And that's what we base our confidence in, and the relationship is built upon. If you will take your songbook and turn to number 244, as always, there's relevance and application of all of this. Here's a song